Hey, listeners, surprise, surprise. It is Epercussion Podcast. We have a little reunion episode for you. It's been well over a year since our last podcast and since we initially ended the show. The show is still over, but we wanted to get together and chat. We've kept in touch and we've kept our chat thread going throughout the year and we just wanted to get back together. So it's the old crew. It's Carly Vigna, it's Ksenia Komjanovic, it's Caleb Pickering, Ben Charles, and I'm Casey Cangelosi. So we talk about AI and copyright. We talk about percussion concertos. So enjoy and thanks for listening. Bye.
Ksenia made this great Facebook post about percussion concertos and in so many words, it was, why are piano, violin, and cello concertos always programmed and other instruments, including percussion, maybe don't get as much love and attention. And Caleb and I actually just performed the Russell Peck triple percussion concerto called The Glory and the Grandeur. And so since we were fired up about percussion concertos and talking about percussion concertos today, I wanted to present three percussion concertos that maybe people aren't as familiar with, but that are by some pretty large name composers. So I think everyone's familiar with like the Schwantner Concerto or the Higdon Concerto. Those are kind of the two really big ones that get a lot of airtime. But some of the other ones I wanted to point out, I've got three today. Has anyone here ever heard the Henry Cowell percussion Concerto for Percussion and Orchestra? Yeah, so Henry Cowell, like the Henry Cowell that we know that wrote that great piece, Ostinato Pianissimo, he wrote a concerto for a percussion ensemble. I believe it's timpani plus four percussionists that was premiered in 1961 by the Kansas City Philharmonic Orchestra. And again, I will stress this is 1961. The solos were Vera Dalin, Ben, I'll probably mess up the names, but Vera Dalin, Ben Udell, Karen K. Bichet, Judy Duffin, and Vincent Bilardo, which means that in 1961, this piece premiered with three, count them, three female percussion soloists. So that's, I think, pretty awesome. Yeah. And one of the parts is a xylophone part, and just listening to it, it's pretty akin to the xylophone part in Ostinato Pianissimo, which is to say that it's super difficult. I was able to find a recording of it on YouTube. I couldn't find a commercial recording on like a streaming service, but check that one out. The next one I wanted to point out, Toru Takemitsu, who I think everyone knows from his piece Rain Tree for two marimbas and vibraphone, wrote a percussion concerto in 1990 for the Boston Symphony Orchestra with Nexus as the soloist and Seiji Ozawa conducting. It was written for the Carnegie Hall Centennial Season, and there is a recording of Nexus with the Pacific Symphony. And then on YouTube, I managed to find a video of the Berlin Phil. There's a little clip. There's also a recording of Amadinda with the Hungarian National Philharmonic Orchestra. And Ksenia, you'll be happy to hear that there's also a recording of Steve Schick conducting this work. And so it's one of Takemitsu's later works. One of the sort of cool features of this piece is that there's these colored ribbons that go all the way from the stage up to the ceiling, and the ribbons are tied to bells and chimes. And at the end of the piece, the players play these bells and chimes that are suspended way at the top of the hall with these long, beautiful colored ribbons going down. And then also one, Casey, I don't think I ever said the name. It's from Me Flows What You Call Time. But yeah, and then one of the parts, the part that Bob Becker played was written for steel drums. And Bob Becker has a great article, you can find it on the Nexus website, about learning this part. And this is Bob Becker, the world's greatest xylophone player, amazing rudimental snare drummer, etc. And he's basically said, I have never played steel drum ever. And so he had to buy the instrument and find a flight case that would work with that instrument. I think he said he repurposed one from something else. I can't remember. But he said he played this piece for several years with just how he could figure out to suspend and play the steel drums. And he ran into Andy Norell and showed Andy Norell, the famous steel drum player, his setup. And Andy looked at his steel drums and he said, they're backwards. The left one's supposed to be on the right and the right one's supposed to be on the left. But Bob Becker just said, you know, with no cultural reference to this instrument or anything, that I didn't know. I just set it up in a way that made sense. And that's how I learned to play it. And then the last one I wanted to talk about today is the Libby Larson Marimba Concerto. It's called Marimba Concerto After Hampton, written in sort of a response to continuing the legacy of Lionel Hampton, the famous jazz vibraphone player. There's a recording available of John Kinsey with the Colorado Symphony under Maren Alsop, that I was able to find on YouTube of this. It was premiered in 1992 by my dear teacher, William Bursch, with the Long Beach Symphony and Joanne Faletta as the conductor. It was commissioned by a consortium of several American orchestras. You can find that full list on Libby Larson's website. And this piece fulfilled William Bursch's dream of being a marimba soloist with a professional symphony orchestra. And one cool feature of this one is the third movement includes a feature for the percussion section as well as the marimba soloist. So it's cool to hear the orchestra percussion get featured as well. And when Mersch talked about this work, I believe he said it was the San Antonio Symphony. He performed at several places, but he said when he finally landed in San Antonio, that was his favorite orchestra to perform this work with. So three percussion concertos you might not know. So anyway, Ksenia, why don't you tell us about your research? Actually, it looks like Carly has something real quick.
Well, if we're really going in order, Caleb had something. But I'm going to steamroll in honor of tradition. No, it's just, Bennett, you're talking about Bob Becker, like having to figure out steel pan and how do you set it up and all this. And doesn't it just make you feel better about life knowing that like people like Bob Becker have to figure that stuff out too?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's like it's very humanizing. And actually, my percussion ensemble right now is playing Bob Becker's piece called Palta, which is a drum set feature, and it has a steel pan part. And I gave it to the student. He's like, I've never played steel pan before. I don't know. And I was like, read this article. Here you go.
Well, that was me last month figuring out how to play tapan for the Bates Concerto. That someday somebody's going to watch me play tapan and be like, you're doing it backwards and upside down.
What is tapan?
The Bulgarian drum. Well, perhaps Ksenia could tell us more.
Yeah, well, one would think she could, but she couldn't. But I think the point is, because I played that same concerto, is like, you don't learn how to play the instrument, you learn how to play the concerto. And of course, you can, you know, sort of strike any surface. But can I find my way around a steel pan or a tapan as a virtuoso improv? No, I cannot. But, you know, I can figure my way through something that's
really you're a famous concerto, so. Bulgarian percussionist. You might be.
Sadly, not my story. So, yeah, but the tapan is a giant drum that you hang sort of across your body and then you strike it with some, it's usually like rose stems. But now they make them all fancy and you can have a Bulgarian flag as
long, thin, like whippy stick, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then a more of a hammer, like also for the bass.
Yeah, that's so cool. That's kind of my favorite answer, you know, when we're coaching students or interviews or whatever, like, you know, tell me your greatest weakness. It's like, my favorite answer to that is like, the same weakness every percussionist has, like, hey, you know, any day now, there's going to be a instrument that you've never played before that you're going to come up to, and yep, you got to figure out how to do it right there and then. And or a student's going to ask you to teach them something that you haven't done before. I mean, you know, you show knowledge about like the percussion field at large while also saying like, yeah, sure, it's a weakness, but it's just the nature of percussion too. When you have to teach all percussion or possibly play all percussion, I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, let's have the harp professor also teach cello. I mean, it's literally like how far apart some of these instruments are. And I mean, I've repeated that for years. I've never had anybody challenge it. You know, it's like, no, this is pretty well accepted nowadays too, since percussion has spread so well. Do you guys have any thoughts? Like, I mean, it's amazing. Like Henry Cowell concerto that like we don't know about. Like, what, you know, how I posted some table music reels, Terry DeMay table music recently, and I was just happy. And also kind of shocked how many like shares and views and how many comments they got and how many people. I just got the sense like, dude, nobody on Instagram knows this piece. Like, but I think to all of us that like grew up studying it, we teach, it just seems like commonplace, but it just kind of reminds me like, A, when we talk about our repertoire, I think we do have to bother to say like, table music by Terry DeMay. It's a piece for three tables, a lot of graphic notation, a lot of visual aspect, you know, like we have to do that. But also it's amazing that like Ben can present these three percussion concertos that are like, yeah, kind of like lost or few and far between they get played. And I don't know, it's just, it's kind of interesting. Like how the heck do these, what should be really big, well-played pieces get
lost.
It reminds me of, we had studio today and we did just some listening as opposed to like playing or anything like that. And yeah, it was the same thing as like, they knew the name Velocities by Joseph Schwantner. They knew that was a piece, but that was probably the first time most of them had actually sat down with the score and followed along and listened. But we listened to that and a couple other things. And no, it's funny. Yeah, you mentioned that, like the things that are commonplace. Like I have a newish piece, Carve Into Me What You Call Love, but the form and the title is taken from that through Takemitsu, From Me Flows What You Call Time. And it's like there's a lot of, I don't know. Yeah, I guess maybe for us, it's just, oh, yes, the piece. I've always known about it, but I can't like recall a time not knowing about that stuff, even though I know that was probably 10 to 15 years ago for me.
Well, and Caleb, we had studio today too, and they did a run of your piece, Berserker, and you've got a really famous quote in there from Mirma Spiritual. And it was yeah, amazing. And I mean, I think, you know, my studio, I mean, they're pretty well trained, well versed, pretty well experienced, and like still, I mean, a lot of them weren't sure what it was. And once they said like Marimba Spirit, they're like, oh yeah, right, that's a piece I should know. But very few were like absolutely sure, like, oh yeah, that is like the middle section of Marimba Spiritual in there. So I don't know.
I love the note on the score of Berserker at that one point, it says spiritually.
Yeah. I saw that. I was like, ah, oh, Caleb,
I'm getting my money's worth.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. What do you got there, Ksenia?
Well, I was gonna then get all fired up about concerti. I think the reason why we don't know them is because we don't, or people don't program them. And part of the reason why I started doing that research is because I thought of, I mean, I flew last year to Cleveland to see the premiere of the new percussion concerto by Johannes Maria Staud, that Christoph Zietzen played with the Cleveland Orchestra, whereas The Reality Trembles is called. And I thought, wow, this is the one percussion concerto that I get to hear this year. And that's because I have a job and I have the ability to buy a plane ticket and go somewhere and see this. So it's not even like, it's nowhere near me. And so then I started looking at the biggest orchestras that have the biggest budgets and how often they program concerts. And it was really sad because, I don't know, I looked into 9 of them. And it turned out that 3 of them have not programmed a single percussion concerto in the past 10 years. And so I'm talking about like Boston Symphony Orchestra. The last time they programmed something was in 1996 with Seiji Ozawa. And that was James McMillan's Veni, Veni, Emmanuel. So that's over 25 years ago. That's nuts. So it's been quarter of a century. And if you live in Boston, which should be this big hub of culture and intellect and so on, you cannot go to an amazing orchestra and see someone of you, like a person playing your instrument represented. So when we talk about diversity on stage, the thing that really I notice a lot now is that percussion, as a lot of other wildcard instruments, are not represented very much. And that means that we don't have access to the highest tier of pay, to the highest tier of visibility, which then translates into why do we as percussionists, you know, have issues getting booked for smaller venues, we have issues arguing for our worth and our value in getting paid, you know, for anything else that we do, because we're seen as second class citizens, you know. And so, you know, I looked at this and it's like 3 orchestras have not programmed anything. A few orchestras, 2 orchestras have had 3 concerti in the past 10 years, which is great, like once every 3 years. However, one of those only employed their percussionists to play it. So they weren't people who are soloists. They're orchestral players who play concerti, which, I mean, I don't think would happen with a piano concerto, you know? I don't think an orchestra as big as this one would ever pull up their pianist and then just put them in front of the orchestra, you know? So it was kind of sad to think in these 9 cities in the world that are meccas for art. You could maybe see one concerto. You have seen one concerto in the past 10 years, maybe none. Or if you're lucky in these two places, you could have seen 3. And then there are other issues. Like I, at least in the stuff that I found, there was no woman that I could see. No woman soloist, no person of color soloist. There was only one percussionist that actually played on both continents. It's like, it's very segregated that way. People don't program composers from other continents. It's like, it's all so siloed. It's kind of nuts. And so I just thought that was all completely crazy. And then when I started that conversation on social media, I got a lot of responses saying, well, our repertoire sucks. That was one. Nobody wants to program it that way. And I disagree. I think we have plenty of repertoire. I mean,
if Toru Takemitsu wrote a percussion concerto, I don't think our repertoire sucks. That's,
I mean, yeah,
Darius Milhaud, so many great ones. Yeah.
There people still write for it today. And we have everything from, say, easy listening music to highly intellectual music and in between. I don't think we lack soloists. I don't think we lack virtuosity. I don't think we lack people who want to do this. I think there are other things at play there. I mean, there's maybe a little bit of everything that's a problem. But I just, you know, to me, it was so similar to the whole Hollywood movement that happened, I don't even know if it was a decade ago, when women started coming up and being like, I'm not getting paid the same as my male counterpart in this movie. And it's like not equal pay. And when we're talking about representation, that's important. And I think for us as percussionists, we work our butts off and we're not as hired and we're not as represented. And then again, if you go even deeper into being, say, a person, a minority, you know, a person from an underrepresented group or underprivileged background, I mean, what are your odds of pursuing a career in this? It's insane. So anyway, that was it. Okay, someone else speak instead of me.
Cool. Y'all think, as I see all the time, people playing percussion concertos with groups, but it's always, I hate this phrase, second tier, but like a regional orchestra or regional symphony. You know, somebody that's not their full-time, the players in it, that's not a full-time gig. That's, you know, a chunk of the pie. But I feel like I see percussion concertos more frequently with them. Is that just they're able to take a risk at the expense of the not having wealthy donors chipping in that might pull their funding or anything? Or
also, it's probably cheaper than having a big name piano soloist come in.
Sure. Yeah, I got that.
It's possible. But it was when I posted that, I got a lot of private messages, and so many from people who are in school or who have recently graduated, who said that they switched career paths because they realized that they can't do this. Or people saying, I've always wanted to be a soloist, but then, I don't know, 5 years into my education, I realized that I've never seen a percussion concerto outside of a school setting. Like, I've never seen a professional ensemble do it. And yet I had this dream that I could maybe do it someday. And so then they switched, and now orchestras, and I mean, I don't know, these are some people's accounts, you know, they shared, but they said, orchestras are filled with my friends who are miserable for not being able to pursue a solo career or a chamber music career, and therefore they got stuck in an orchestra. And that's just crazy to think about.
Yeah. And to be clear, I'm in no way doubting any of that. I'm just was making an observation.
How much do you guys think it might have to do with just the logistics of, you know, instrument rental and who's setting it up? And I mean, some pieces, like, it's way easier to do at a school where you have everything.
I don't think the Boston Symphony Orchestra has a logistical problem.
You don't have a budget issue.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Whatever you charge to move a Steinway, I'll do it for cheaper. I mean,
maybe the mid-level.
Well, I was going to ask, like, well, what are your findings, Ksenia? Like, you know, I looked on the thread just once and saw like a lot of opinions and discussion and stuff. And I don't know, like, do you like how, what is kind of your answer that you're getting from people as they try to explain it? I'm sure none of us really know.
What's
the feeling out there?
I really, so one thing that I've noticed with my duo, because I am now talking to more people and like figuring all of these bookings out and so on, and talking to managers and learning about, say, concerto soloists.
You guys should play the Rite of Spring again.
We should play the Rite of Spring. Thank you. What a brilliant idea. Never thought of that before. I hear from people that it's very hard to book percussion. So even people representing, you know, soloists that we all may look up to and think have very glorious careers, they say it's very, very difficult. People don't want to pay for this. And I am not sure if that came from, say, people having a percussion concert, the presenter putting one on, and then ticket sales being terrible, and then them feeling like they don't want to do it, or they sold one out, but then it was something that was so loud that so many members of the audience came back and said, that was too loud, I was unhappy, I don't want to do this, blah, blah, blah. So there's that part of it that I hear. The other thing that I hear when it comes to booking my duo, and that is that the Rite of Spring makes us more bookable. It's because it's music people already know, because people don't want to book percussion necessarily, but the fact that it's music that is already recognizable makes it easier. Whereas when we promote percussion music, music written only for percussion, that is so many new things for people that they just can't handle it. Again, I think we might be also underestimating our audiences, that they're not curious, that they're not open-minded, and all these things. But I'm not sure. I hear people saying all kinds of things, that it's bad rep, that it's the logistics are terrible, that so on and so forth. I'm not sure.
I just wanted to interject really quickly with Ksenia was saying, in so many words, like some orchestras are like, oh, audiences aren't ready for that, something along those lines. And on Ksenia's post, Jennifer Higdon, left a comment, and she said, after my first percussion concerto was premiered, I learned that audiences go absolutely bonkers for percussion concerti in general. It's one of the most exciting types of concerti that they like to see and hear. Usually the administrators and conductors just don't know enough of them to think of programming them.
Well, and that's what I saw that comment, Ben. I thought I saw someone else say that as well. And that's been my experience with them, too, as an audience member. It's like, hey, this seems like this is going great. So, yeah, it is kind of mysterious as to why it's, I don't know, not happening more. This conversation, though, it does sound a lot like the same conversation I've had with living composers trying to get their music performed. So if I had to speculate as to why this is happening, it's like, I think it's because we're just a small piece of the pie of new music. It's the same problem that all new composers tend to have. So yeah, until, you know, they get some big accolade that they can put a stamp on and sell, it's going to be tough to get the work done. Because I composer friends talk about this all the time, like, okay, they'll play Beethoven 5 for the 50th time this season, but they played and you'll see you know, very much the same way you described it, Ksenia, like, this many orchestras only played this many new works and only did this many things that haven't already been played and aren't from the old canon. And they might even cite a major symphony orchestra that hasn't done a new piece in, you know, a decade or something. I mean, it sounds very, very, very similar.
When Ben and I and Ben Tomlinson from Kingsville, we did, like Ben was saying, The Glory and the Grandeur. The piece before ours had a huge drum set solo from one of Ben's students. And afterwards, the crowd ate it up. And then we did the percussion concerto and people were like hooting and hollering in the audience. And then everything else got a very nice round of applause, even though it was very good music. But yeah, those percussion concertos, like, people get hyped over those.
Well, I think we're at a place. I mean, this goes back to what we were just talking about early on about, like, hey, people on Instagram don't recognize table music. Students today might not recognize Marimba Spiritual. I don't think they know Glory and Grandeur from Beethoven 5. You know, like, it's kind of getting to that point where those are maybe equal now. And I don't know, it's going to take the industry some time to catch on to that, I guess.
It brings to mind so much for me the famous line from Jonathan Haas, and we talked about this when he was on the podcast, but he wanted to do a solo timpani concerto in Carnegie Hall in the 80s. And so he applied for a grant for it, and they wrote back and said, we're sorry, Mr. Haas, but we only sponsor musical instruments. It's like they just couldn't picture a solo timpani recital, which, I mean, admittedly, like, even today, that's kind of hard for probably us to do, but yeah, certainly it's possible. It's like, you don't know it. You're not going to like it.
Ksenia, can you kind of envision, or do you have any sympathy for like the flipped opinion? I'm thinking like perspective of a violinist who they're like, yeah, there's a bazillion orchestras that want to book a violin solo, but there's also a gazillion violinists, and you might be able to argue like, hey, making as a solo violinist is more competitive than being a solo percussionist, because at least there are fewer solo percussionists. And you can also find like you can find your niche within percussion, whereas like, man, classical violin, I don't know, unless you have like a particular piece that has your stamp on it through some composer in some way, I wonder if they, I don't know, they feel, you know, they feel a similar burden, like trying to get out of the masses of other violinists doing what they're doing.
I mean, for sure, they are pianists, violinists. They have a bigger platform, but it's also so much more crowded. But I'm looking at this more of like, I cannot assume what Yu Jiawang makes, but I can assume that no percussionist makes that, or maybe even half of that. I'm not saying she's phenomenal, but it's just like, and we're not alone in this. I'm looking at this from my selfish point of view as like percussionist and what I need to talk to my students about, whether this is realistic and how to pursue this career. But I'm also talking about French horn players. And, you know, when people are like, oh, we don't have repertoire or it's too new, blah, blah, blah. I mean, look at clarinet players. They're not doing much hotter either. And, you know, it's just like, how is it possible that 95% of concerto bookings are piano, violin, and cello, and then 5% is for every other instrument, like all other instruments combined? It's just a little bit lopsided, and I think not very interesting. I was looking up Carnegie Hall's archive of performances, and they had, I don't know, this was published maybe 10 years ago, I don't remember exactly, but it was like, they performed, I think, the Beethoven piano concerto like 289 times by that time. I mean, seriously, like twice a year, you know, whereas two percussion concerti in the past, whatever, however many years.
Well, that's my composer discussion. You know, it's that it's like, well, there isn't room for this new stuff because they, I guess, feel they have to keep programming the, I don't know, in the old model that must work, you know.
What you got? I want to help them, though, change their minds.
Sure. Right.
I'm feeling like it's kind of a risk aversion thing as we kind of discuss it more. Like they don't know if people will like it. They, you know, they don't know if will donors fund this? Will people buy tickets? But I want to open up a whole other can of worms here. How does this apply like in schools with concerto competitions? And, you know, we just revamped our concerto competition process for the next time we go through it. A couple of weird things happen. One, now the whole instrumental division, winds, brass, strings, is lumped in with keyboard for, I guess, the second round. I can't remember. But there's a first round that is now just percussion, harp, and guitar. So they announced the first regrouping, and it was like, oh, now we're with pianists. Like, how do we ever win? And then it was like, oh, but the first round is percussion, harp, guitar. Hey, we stand a chance there. And just, yeah, representation in those competitions. And, you know, I feel like every time a percussionist wins, it's like a win for the whole team. Like, it's like, yes, even if it's two percussionists like going against each other, but I see posts and it's like, hey, good. Like they're doing good stuff over there.
I just wanted to raise one more quick point to kind of tag along to Carly's point. Maybe other people have different opinions about this, but one issue I find is, not all, there's certainly some concertos that don't fall under this category, but so many of our percussion concertos are so modernist and written for Evelyn Glennie, which is fantastic, but maybe not something that a college junior has, you know, at their disposal. And there might not be a piano reduction because it's so new and it's not necessarily intended for the college percussion concerto audience, so to speak. And then, again, like I said, that's certainly not all of them. There are some fantastic concertos that are accessible to a relatively young but, you know, experienced student that have a piano reduction, that have a band version, et cetera. So I'm not saying that's all concertos, but I feel like there are many concertos. Other instruments have more concertos that are accessible for that sort of competition. I don't know if anyone disagrees, but Ksenia's nodding her head a little bit, so I think that maybe I'm somewhat right.
I mean, yes, there's much of that. Sorry, but I think that there are plenty of composers that have written pieces that are good for in between. It's just that we don't hear them or know them well enough to program them.
I mean, even the Rosario is like pretty manageable for advanced high schoolers, undergrad. The Mio concertos.
Absolutely. Creston.
Creston. Yeah.
I had a student win with Prism Rhapsody here a couple of years ago.
Nice.
Is it comfortable on y'all's steamroller? Is it lonely up there? I was thinking the same thing. I'm actually judging a concerto competition next week. I won't say where, but it is grouped. It's strings and piano, voice, and then woodwind, brass, percussion. So it's like, wow, that's kind of, yeah, I mean, that's a huge, I mean, voice on its own, sure. You know, maybe piano and strings, a little weird, but that's two categories into one. But all the brass, all the woodwind, all the percussion just crammed into one group. It'll be a long evening, but it's weird that that group is competing against themselves to be in the final round.
We do it by areas here. So it's like brass and percussion have a preliminary round that they can get to the finals. Voice area, same. Piano, same. Strings, same. And it, so far, it feels pretty good. I mean, Caleb won. I had another marimba solo win. And a bunch of people have gotten to finals. Like student Tyler played Arvner Dorman, got to finals. Student Josh got to finals just this last time around. So like, I don't know, it feels pretty well balanced. I was gonna ask Ksenia, have you compared this to, like, I mean, I can't imagine there's many, but like, you know, the Arnd Martineau soloists, like, first of all, there's probably four of them in the world, you know, playing an Arnd Martineau solo or a theremin concerto or something. Like there's probably fewer theremin virtuosos. No, Ben, we talked about this instrument. You can't tease me. Arnd Martineau, we like focused on this instrument for like a whole episode. But like, that's even a more rare and odd instrument, probably both in amount of players and repertoire. But you got to imagine, like, looking at them like, oh, well, if you're a theremin soloist, cool, there probably are very few orchestras that are able to book you, but I bet you get every single one of them. You know what I mean? So did you get to compare?
I did not. I did that in my head. I did not do this scientifically. But again, if we're talking about theremin, I mean, theremin is not represented, say, in every music school in the US. And therefore, you know, it's kind of like a different funnel. We fall out of the funnel, even though we exist everywhere else educationally. And theremin is not exactly represented, which it should be. Why not? It's a magical instrument. I think one of the things that I thought, unless I'm steamrolling someone right now, is I've been watching this video series. What is it called? Living the Classical Life, I think. And in it, there was an interview with Yuja Wang's teacher. And interestingly enough, so, I mean, what's the point of a concerto competition or any big competition? Yes, young people get to train and put themselves out there and, you know, do something special. But if you think about big competitions, Queen Elizabeth and, I don't know, Clyburn and blah, blah, blah. The point is that you are heard by someone who can maybe activate your career from then on, right? For percussion, it doesn't seem like many people pay attention to our largest competitions in order to launch us elsewhere, right? And so listening to the episode where her teacher spoke, I remember him saying that he told her she doesn't need to compete because that's a waste of time. She doesn't need to waste energy on that. Because he has been this big man who, with a big career as a concerto soloist, he had all the contacts. So he said, you'll learn all this repertoire. And then when you're ready, I'll invite all the conductors and all the important people to come hear you out in a room. And we will launch your career that way. So instead of, you know, her going through this crowded space of competing, he gave her his contacts because he believed in her. And if we look at our first generation of concerto soloists, if we look at, you know, Evelyn Glennie or Colin Curry, so some of those folks, they don't teach anywhere necessarily. They don't train young people. They don't, at least not that I am aware of, that they, you know, like actively pass down contacts. They've not retired from performing like this man has. So he gets to pass down the contacts. And I think in the world of music, I mean, Yuja Wang's dad is a percussionist. And if you look at like all these things, Martin Grubinger, who was one of the most successful ones, his dad was also a percussionist. Like people who come from generations of musicians have a wealth of contacts that they work with, and they have a little bit of an easier time. And with percussionists, if you look at the young generation who wants to get into concerto soloist careers, they have no one to mentor them. I mean, maybe that's where we're young, and maybe that's where we don't have what we need to. But I've heard this, I think this was Daniel Trifonov's story as well. Even though he won one competition, it was like, don't worry, you're fine. I'll arrange someone to come listen to you when you're ready to be heard. You don't have to like do this stuff like everyone else. I don't think we have people in that position of power.
Yeah, that's just like to imagine that kind of exchange happening in lessons is like pretty amazing. What a contrast from what we do. I wonder if there's an element of like scarcity that, I don't know, the people that are getting the percussion concerto gigs, if we invite more people into the fold, you know, are there still going to be gigs for enough to go around if orchestras aren't programming?
True.
I don't know. Double-edged sword.
Well, I remember, I think Ben told a story, which of course was someone else's story. I mean, because we've had a, you know, definitely a lot of older percussionists on the show. So maybe it was one of their teacher stories or something, but it is my favorite story it was of how it used to be. It was
you're thinking of I think Alan Abel, how he won his job with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Well let me, you might be right, let me tell this real quick. Yeah. It goes like this. It goes, a teacher who plays in the symphony has their student sub for them. The conductor says, hey, your student was really great. And then the teacher says, oh, you thought that student was great? Well, you should hire this other one. They're even better. And they hire the other one that they never heard. They never played.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was Alan Abel. And I think it was like, right? I think it was whatever teacher had a student audition for Philadelphia, then maybe won another job. And the guy was like, well, just hire this guy instead. And
right. Yeah. So I just kind of wonder, like, I mean, none of us have seen that happen in our lifetime. I'm sure, I'm not saying it doesn't still happen, it might, but I wonder if it's just such an oddity. Like if you were to do a real study about all this, those would just be like outliers that are just like weird, you know, people who just got it handed to them, you know. Like I wonder how much that does actually still happen, you know, with, you know, even like the major performers, you know.
Sure. And it's not to say, I mean, the examples I mentioned, they're very deserving of their careers. They worked very hard, but connections and having someone who is on your side and has all of that already figured out and is willing to pass it down to you, that's just, I mean, that's so valuable.
Yeah, right. That'd be winning the lottery. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But it's weird. It's weird when we discuss this with students. And of course, like we can try to do this for them as best we can. I mean, obviously we don't have those kind of connections. We have some kind of connections, you know, that can help them, and we can talk on their behalf and write them really robust letters of recommendation. We can do all the connection type of things we can do. But like, I don't know how. Is it, it's not helpful, right? To be like, oh, the world's like really unfair for you. And, you know, what are you going to do? Like, you, if nothing's going to be given to you, like, I don't know. I feel like there's so much, you know, I get yelled at on social media a lot because I advocate for like working hard, and people are like, how dare you tell tell us to work hard. Like, well, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the students who might be listening. And like, well, how dare you make tell them to work hard and they shouldn't have to be miserable to be successful. And then I again say, like, I'm not saying how it should be. I'm just saying how it is. I'm not saying it's like we should have to work hard. Hell, I think it'd be great if none of us had to work at all and the world just took care of us. That'd be awesome. But if we're going to give them like practical, realistic advice, it's like, yeah, you're probably not going to make one of those connections. So you better go the route that most people have had to go. And of course, you know them, you work with them, you know their personality, and you think like, oh, yeah, I think they want to do this. They'd be up for this. You know, so stop yelling at me.
We you and I have talked about this before, Casey, with things like anytime you do one of those things, the people that read it, the people who need to absorb the information are upset by it. And then the people that don't need to absorb the information are also upset by it. And it just turns into like, wait. Half of you are mad because you think this is about you, but it's not about you. And the other half are mad because it's about you, but you don't realize it's about you quite yet. But yeah, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I don't know, like when we're telling these people what to do, I mean, given what they say they want, like it's like, well, I think we just have to be realistic, you know. Anyway. And I mean, not that it's not important to know what you just described. I mean, of course it is. Like, hey, you know, the person you're up against may have a free may have won the lottery, and that's the real world and part of the real world you have to live in. And it's, of course, it's only helpful to know that. And there's nothing to know that isn't going to be helpful on that journey, I would think.
Ben Charles and other Ben at Kingsville and I, when we were doing that concerto, we were talking, and this is not a slant, but we were just talking about percussion solos and stuff. And it was just like, man, yeah, it's, if you have like a significant other or independently wealthy, it's like, yeah, I might be able to take the time to be a world-class percussion concerto soloist. If I literally don't have to consider making a literal, like keeping a roof over my head and like food on my table and a gas in my car, then totally. Yeah. It's just a privilege.
Find issue. Yourself a patron.
I'm going to find myself a sugar daddy. Ben, what are you doing? You got any money? You don't got any money.
Ben doesn't do anything. No. I'm a percussionist also.
You guys wait till you have kids and then what happens to this conversation. So yeah, not only that,
but you can send your kids to work to pay for everything.
You have to work to pay for stuff. You have no time. Hey, something we've talked about on the show before, and I've always thought it was kind of boring. But a lot of people are talking about it right now. I mean, not talking about it y'all is boring, but I think it's been a boring topic, and it's been AI. I've just never really been excited to talk about it. And not that I'm super excited to talk about it now, but like, it's a little more interesting to me all of a sudden. And, we talked about it a couple of ways on the show in the past, and I just jotted the episode numbers down. I think the first time it ever came up, and this was kind of before AI hit like what it is today, ChatGPT, and hey, students can have a program write their papers for them, and all before all that happened that it is today, we talked about something called the Next Rembrandt. And also composer David Cope's music way back on episode 46. That's 046, like back in the 60s, long time ago. And if you recall, and maybe actually Ben might be the only one who was on that one, but a group of researchers and engineers, computer engineers, photographers, and folks got together, and they photographed every single Rembrandt painting. Rembrandt's famous painter from the 1600s, Danish, I believe, Rembrandt, I think. And they, of course, in their detailed photography, they measured proportion, you know, expression, they measured distance of eyes, you know, they took all this information and then they generated a new Rembrandt. So you can watch this on YouTube. It's called The Next Rembrandt. Oh, thank you, Dutch. The next Rembrandt, and like it's a very convincing new Rembrandt painting that they made, but I mean it's very much generative AI. Along with that, I talked about composer David Cope, who you might have heard of, who generated way back in the 60s new Bach pieces, new Vivaldi pieces. He was able to feed musical information and train his software to create new works. And they're really, really convincing. I mean, they sound very, very, very good. So my estimation, I'm going to put a pretty bold estimation out there. I think this whole AI thing is not going to disappear, but it's kind of going to blow over as a big deal. I guess the reason I think so is because I've seen some lawsuits recently that have been happening. So I have a few questions for you guys. Do you think it's copyright violation for, let's say, a company takes Getty images? This is a real lawsuit. Get all, you know, millions of Getty images, which are copyrighted, and they feed that into their AI machine and use it to train their AI to then pump out realistic replications of things their users input. Do you think that is a copyright violation? And I want you to kind of answer it two ways: legally, but then also like if your own feelings, like would you call that legal or illegal? What do you say, Caleb?
I'm going to say it is illegal legally if depending on the use. And okay. Then I'm going to say morally, it's big effed up. I think that's really okay. A crappy thing to do. But it reminds me of like, you probably might be the only one that knows about this or have heard about this. There's a game called Helldivers. This came out recently.
I've heard
and
that.
The entire premise, the models for everything is ripped from the 1997 movie Starship Troopers, which is like a very tongue-in-cheek comedy, not comedy, action movie, but dark comedy overtone about, you know, yeah, it's ridiculous. But they are not in any bad legal standings, even though it is exactly, it is replica. The only thing they don't do is they've transformed it just enough, you know, with the gray area of fair use, whatever that means.
Yeah, so there's a word that's so that might be labeled a derivative word.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of for the AI stuff. It would be derivative of the other thing, but I don't know.
Right, so I think that's why it's a little weird, because like you could easily see a derivative connection there. Which I don't know, might be okay. That's the other thing. Like, I think people confuse fair use a lot. Like, fair use is a protection, but you also, you know, you may spend years in court trying to prove it's a fair that fair use applies, and you very well may lose that. The kind of two arguments. One, it sounds like Caleb agrees with, and I think I generally agree with, like, yeah, you can't take copyrighted stuff, train this thing that then you're going to sell. You know, that like people purchase the AI applications and they use them, but it was copyrighted stuff that made the AI system valuable. If they didn't have all the good copyrighted art to put in there, the thing would pump out garbage. So they absolutely, it seems like they should owe royalties to wherever the original copyright thing they used to train would be. The other argument is that, hey, this is how every creative process works. And I was going to mention another episode we did, which is much more recent. And it was, where's my notes? It was, I was with Pius Chang and Gene Kaczynski. They're just, I don't know if you've heard of those guys. They're just a bunch of guys. But I talked about a term called cryptoamnesia. And cryptoamnesia is a phenomenon where you repeat something that you learned long ago, but forgot you learned it. And the classic example is, I forget the comedian's name, but one comedian stealing another comedian's joke. Louis C.K. is the one who's stolen from. I forget the other guy. But anyway, the point is, like, you could hear something, totally forget it, and think it was your own. So don't we kind of do the same thing that AI does. And then I could say, like, hey, I wrote this new work by Casey Cangelosi, and you wouldn't recognize it as sounding like anything but my own. However, I was inspired by everything I've absorbed my whole life. I trained my machine to create new stuff that is really only iterations of other stuff I've heard. And that's what that crypto amnesia topic is. It's like, yeah, nothing is truly actually original. I mean, everything we do. So why do we get copyright protection, but the AI algorithms and systems don't? I mean, it can end there. That's fine.
That's one of those things, like I can smell my internal mind computer like making smoke when I think about that one. Yeah,
Well,
that
I guess
was
I'll
going to be
tell
my point
you.
as well.
Well, I guess I'll tell you why I kind of think it's going to blow over. I mean, we first of all, the two examples we already gave, the next Rembrandt, like no one cared. D David Cope, nobody cared. I mean, these things happen, and it makes a big splash, and tons of people go like, "Oh my God, it's the end of music creation as we know it." MP3 happened. Everybody cared. Everybody freaked out. But the industry caught up to a way to deal with it, and then a way to deal with streaming. I mean, I don't think it's good. I don't know if we're in a better place, but at least like the industry is now part of it. So it seems fairly practical that, like, okay, if you're going to train an AI machine that you're going to sell, then you would have to disclose what you're putting in, and you would have to get the consent of the copyrighted material that you're putting in, and you'd maybe have to pay them some kind of royalty. And I would think that because it takes, hundreds of thousands to several million pieces of input to generate good AI art. I mean, if someone emailed Caleb Pickering and said, "Hey, I'm creating a music generative AI machine that I need to train. Can I pay you royalties for all your works?" And then there would be some system of determining, like, well, okay, how much was the Caleb Pickering algorithm accessed in this one person's entry? But I'm guessing, since it would also have to be with so many others to combine and make it right, like whatever royalties they could pay, I'm guessing Caleb would say, yeah, no thanks. That sounds like fractions of cents for just getting other people to rip me off.
It reminds me of like a pyramid scheme, like the upline. It's like, okay, you're gonna pay me because you're borrowing my music. Oh well, shoot. Well, I was listening to a lot of Casey's music. Okay, well, Casey was listening to a lot of Ravel, so I guess we pay the estate of Ravel. Okay, well, Ravel was, and it just keeps going back in time until you're just paying like this tiny little
Well,
cell microbe.
yep. Well,
What's
and
his
that's how the lawsuits, all the traditional copyright lawsuits go, which is, hey, Lady Gaga ripped off Madonna. Well, Madonna's defense is like, yeah, but my song is just an older version of this other song, which is just an older version of this older song, and it just goes back. It's like that's the really, really good defense. What do you got, Ksenia?
Wait, it was Ben. Ben has to go first.
Go,
No,
Ben.
you go.
Okay, I go. Well, I was gonna say I tried using, or I did use ChatGPT's Dolly yesterday, and I was trying to generate some image, and I asked it to do something in the style of a long dead painter, and it told me it cannot. I can use descriptive terms, I can say I want something postmodern or abstract or impressionistic or whatever, but due to, copyright, it cannot do that. And I thought that was great, because I need to describe the art in a different way if I want it to be generated. But I think that in terms of this kind of stuff, yes, we should pay artists, especially now that we can, because we know what we want to feed the beast with. Why not get a little bit of money, trickling in for royalty, and why not
Well,
actually name, what the influences are for things that we're generating? I don't think it necessarily needs to be a bad thing in that way, if it's all accounted for financially and in terms of, naming who inspired this work or who fed this work.
Well, that's what I'm kind of curious about. Like, can we actually pay the artists? Like, my example, of course, I was speaking for Caleb, really speaking for myself. Like, if they emailed me and was like, hey, we can pay you, like, basically, I mean, it would have to be some things. Like, will it have to be worth my while? And I can't imagine they could make, especially since there's so many of them now, like, a lot of companies have these AI generative things. I mean, like, how many can they? They can't pay out like all the millions of people that made those Getty images, you know, or I mean, maybe they can, but it would be so minuscule that I suspect that the artist would say, yeah, no, thank you. And then all of a sudden they don't have a good product and now nobody's buying it. And you're getting more messages on your chat GPT saying, sorry, Dr. Kumyanovich, I can't produce that. You need to like ask me a better question. And then you're like, well, I'm not subscribing to this anymore. And that's why I'm kind of thinking like, I bet it's gonna go away.
It could happen, but I think what also might happen, I totally agree, but what also might happen is that people, in order to feed the machine, they must hire artists to produce source material. So instead of paying you for your existing work, you know, in peanuts, maybe they're gonna hire, I don't know, if it's a photographer, they're gonna hire a photographer and say, go out, make all this stock photography of people walking down the street. Here's $1,000 for 2 days, and we'll use that to feed this thing. Is that okay? And then that way it might be more useful, you know. And I think it's still great that you as an artist have a say if you want your art to be fed into the machine and for what money or not, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think people get way overblown about the quality of AI. My partner Anna does AI work. I mean, granted, she's smart. She has a master's. She's very good at it. You can just sign up with your billing and credit information, and they'll throw you prompts and be like, "Which one did AI do better? Click on the one that they did the picture better, or." Did they tell anyone how to make a pipe bomb? Yes or no? And it's just people just out there clicking yes or no, like this was a good answer, this was a bad answer. So I don't know. I feel like it's one of those things that seems super scary, but I can't remember who, not Steve Wozniak, but one of those people that is with Apple or whatever was talking about it, and they're like, yeah, this AI stuff, it's I can't read the chat. Yeah, they're just talking about, yeah, the AI stuff. Yeah, it is helpful, but it's so far behind where people think it is. And I mean, I kind of get it. Like, you know, when I've done, I mean, I put music stuff into Chat GPT all the time and ask, and it just gives out just incorrect information. You know, what's a blues, or can you build me a blues scale based on C? And it's like, well, okay, well, there's no D flat or A flat in there. I'm not sure why you gave me those pitches, but I think it's pretty far off, like lofty, if I
Might be pretty
use
far
that
off.
word.
I saw Steve Wozniak give a talk in Dallas sometime around 2016, and he talked exactly about what Caleb just talked about. He said, you know, you show AI pictures of dogs and it can correctly identify a dog 99% of the time, but a 5-year-old child can identify it every time. And then he did this joke of like scientists have actually figured out how to create a human being. Like scientists can now create a human being. It takes 2 people and about 9 months. So, but I just had a couple of thoughts to share. And like one thing that just immediately pinged in my head was that Casey kind of, and I know what you meant by this, but Casey kind of said like, I feel like this thing is kind of like blowing over in a sense. And I know what Casey meant by that, but I don't, and I hope it doesn't. And here's what I mean by that. I saw this clip of Jay Leno talking about cars, and if you know Jay Leno, he's super into cars, has this huge garage with all of these classic cars in it. And he talks about the car saved the horse, because horses used to be these literal workhorses that did just brutal labor day in and day out. And then all of a sudden, the car allowed us to appreciate the beauty of the horse. And like, there's so much stuff that like we just need some sort of, I hate to say filler content, but something. And it's like right now we have to have a human being writing all this copy that it's boring. It's menial work. It's not, you know, any any more enlightening or fulfilling for a human being to do that than, you know, quote unquote, flipping burgers. And so I think the AI like allows our creativity to blossom because we don't have to think about those things so much. And one other topic we discussed, I don't know what episode it was on the podcast, but was anyone around when we talked about the Thomas Kincaid paintings?
Yeah.
Casey, do you remember that one? And like someone wrote some Thomas Kincaid rant.
Yeah, that was one of mine.
Yeah, we read it and like it talks about like, if anyone's not familiar, Thomas Kincaid is this famous like sort of artist that his whole thing was the painter of the light or something like that. And he made all these like very sort of like almost Disney-esque looking paintings and people liked them. But in terms of like, what is art? Like every art critic would tell you it's garbage. And sort of one of the responses to this was like, well, we need art to go on postcards. Like we need just sort of mediocre, regular, plain looking art that goes on postcards. Like that makes the rest of the art actually valuable. Yeah, and it's like, it does feel weird to put some great famous piece of art on a postcard that's gonna get all crumpled up and bent up in the mail. So I don't know, like I'm probably the least interested person in AI. I've never used ChatGPT or any of this. But I do find that for, you know, humanity as a whole, that's a great thing that AI can handle all the boring stuff and we can hopefully all more do more creative work and become a more enlightened species, if you will, because of that.
Just real quick to Jay Leno's horse point, the car saving the horse. What about like, it's going to look really different if the horse ever goes extinct? Then it's like, oh, what did the car do? We would have kept horses around, you know. If we if we lose interest in the horse, well, that would have kept it. I mean, I don't think we will anyway.
Well, that's kind of dark, Casey.
Yeah, quit horsing around.
I think we'll keep interest in the horse, but.
But what if, you know, Ben, I will challenge you for the least interested in AI. I've been quiet this whole conversation. I don't use it. I don't really fully understand it, but I used ChatGPT in practicality for something one time and it helped me write a really difficult professional email where I needed to be careful with my words. And I won't get into details. I just kind of, you know, described what I needed to do, what the circumstances were, what I needed to say. And of course I edited it, what it popped out, but it was like pretty good. And it saved me a lot of time. So yeah, if the horse is us sitting at our computers chained to our inboxes.
I think like there's a great example, like that's probably not an email that you wanted to write or that you were particularly interested in writing and you probably would rather be playing marimba. And like, yeah, like you said, you have to read it, save, you know, edit it, et cetera. But yeah, it saved you a good amount of time probably. And that's like, again, I've never used it, but that's what I've heard is like the quote unquote best use of it is that. I don't think we want to get into this moral dilemma, but obviously students writing essay answers on exams, that's a whole thing.
Well, Carly, you just went up a step because I've never used it. I talked about it a lot today, but I've never used it.
Wow.
I use it.
Ben, maybe we're tied for least interested in AI.
Katinia and I are going to start our own podcast, the AI at AI.
Finally. Okay, you guys go and Ben and
for
I
anyone,
finally
so
go to ours.
If y'all haven't,
Ben, Carly and I.
I use ChatGPT a good amount. I actually used it to write a resignation letter from my last job. And same thing, I wrote it in, gave it the specifics, and then I drafted my own, but it gave me a prompt to base it off of. And that's pretty helpful. The one thing I think it's the best for me and probably for y'all is you can describe an Excel formula that you need and it will just give you the Excel formula. If you want a sheet that adds up this column, if it's this date and this ranking and this other and this delineation, give me the sum total here. And it's really handy because I'm very slow with creating Excel formulas. So
what would you use that for? Like, what's an example of how you would use
like
that?
Like a scoring sheet.
It makes sense what you're saying, but like, I just can't think of a scenario where I would need that.
A scoring sheet. If I want, like right now I have one, it's an Excel file of perspectives for upcoming years. And I have it. I mean, I can just put in like, okay, I want, you know, if it says they may enter fall of 25 and they're at this high school and this thing, then I can just have it just it will pull the information when I need it. I can just click and drop it in and reference it as I need it. It's not bad, you know. It probably would have taken me 20, 30 minutes to do, but, you know, it saved a little time.
I think this conversation's really different outside of art. Like, I think computer coding, it's like way different. Another one of the, I mentioned at least one lawsuit, but one other one that I think no copyright infringement was for data indexing. So someone sued Google, or maybe, sorry, I might be mixing this up, but Google has books. You know, they scan books for indexing information. They don't generate anything. They don't sell the books. No copyright problem there. That seems to be fair use. That falls within fair use. Okay, so they take all this copyrighted material, they feed it into their system so they can guide us to it better and we can buy it. However, Google makes a ton of money being an amazing search engine. So again, it's kind of a similar ethical territory of like, hey, you're taking all this copyrighted material and you're making a tool for all of us to use. And yeah, sure, it doesn't produce anything, but dang, the tool works really, really, really well. And I guess maybe how it's different is there's a mutual benefit. It's like, well, hey, you guided us to this, you know, Google ebook or whatever that someone could now buy.
Hey, real quick, do y'all know about yet another mail merger? It's that weird extension in Gmail. Total time saver. You can email, like, you set up a spreadsheet. Somebody told me how to do it at lunch and then I went and did it. You can set up a spreadsheet with like email address, first name, last name, and then you run the thing through Gmail and it sends everybody like those individual emails like, "Dear Casey, I'm so excited that you filled out an inquiry form on Shenandoah Conservatory's website. If you'd like to at the school." And it's just like, I used to sit there and every applicant, like, I'm actually copy paste, type the name, make sure you put the right program. Yet another mail merger is good.
It's cool. Okay.
I got one of those from you, Carly, but it came up as hello, first name, last name. Is that the same thing?
No, you didn't. I always do the test.
I'm just kidding. That didn't happen.
Yeah, it's the same. Like, that's how you put it in the draft. You write like, hello, first name, comma, I'm so glad you're interested in our music performance program. No, program name program.
I'm worried that the more short automated shortcuts and things like that we find, the more we're going to be expected to do. It's like, at least right now, when I don't reply to everybody, it's like, oh, that's okay. Replying to everybody is ridiculous. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I feel like the expectation already is just overboard. And the more, I don't know, I feel like My protest is like, no, I'm not going to find a solution to this. I'm just going to, you can wait 3 weeks for your reply, or you just might not get one. That's fine too. Like,
imagine you writing letters of recommendation and it's just like, Professor Cangelosi, please send my letter. I want to go to grad school. You're just like, I'll get to it in 3 weeks there.
When we get to, yeah, I mean, prioritize. Well, that's the thing. I mean, Carly's mentioning incoming students. It's frustrating to me to spend a lot of time on students who aren't your students yet, you know, like, it's, yeah, I don't know, like, dude, I know everyone wants a free lesson and we're supposed to like meet and talk with everyone, but like, I don't know, come here if you want to, but like, if you don't, that's fine. I don't know. It's too much, I think. Anyway,
please talk to us about recruiting. I think this is the most effective way of recruiting is ignoring. It's just like in dating. Just ignore the person whose attention you want. That's Casey's method.
Yeah, that's worked since elementary school. That's never failed. Ben's taking notes. Okay, well, thanks for the reunion episode, everyone. Ben, go ahead.
I just had one thing I wanted to say kind of in closing here on Ksenia's concerto topic. And I kind of put in our group chat, did anyone have like a concerto performance that was just like you went to and it just somehow changed you or something like that? And for me, I distinctly remember I'm not positive, but it might have been the first percussion concerto I ever saw performed, at least by a professional symphony orchestra. In 2008, I guess it was, I just looked it up, the end of my junior year of college, I saw Evelyn Glennie on her premiere tour of the Carigliano Percussion Concerto. And I talked about that concerto very briefly on Morris Palter's episode because there's some recordings of him playing it. But it's in three movements. The first movement is for woods. The second movement is for metals. The third movement is for skins. And I just remember the movement for wood. It's based around a marimba and a xylophone, but also with this extended sort of keyboard of all these wood blocks. And I've never actually seen a score for it. I would love to see how it's notated because it just seems sort of impossible to notate all this stuff with as much rapid succession as you have to go back and forth. But it kind of goes along with what we were talking about. I looked up the composer's notes on this concerto, and the opening note of this concerto, we were talking about the fear of the unknown and all. The opening note from John Carigliano on his percussion concerto called Conjurer is, "When asked to compose a percussion concerto, my only reaction was horror." And he talks about, like, as a composer, like, he says, all I could see were problems. While I love using a percussion battery in my orchestral writing, the very thing that makes it the perfect accent to other orchestral sonorities makes it unsatisfactory when it takes a spotlight in a concerto. For starters, a percussionist plays dozens of instruments. Again, this is wonderful if his role is to color an orchestra texture, but if he or she is the main focus, it is terrible. The aural identity of the player is lost amid the myriad bangs, crashes, and splashes of the percussion arsenal. Only the visual element of one person playing all these instruments ties them together. In addition, most of the instruments have no pitch at all or very little and don't sustain a sound like a violin or trumpet. And he goes on to explain how he, you know, got around those challenges with that work. But I can so clearly still picture Evelyn Glennie. I remember I was sitting on the left side and I could see that she had a Yamaha marimba and I think a xylophone and all of these wood blocks. And I remember she played a Deegan Aurora vibraphone. And the last movement starts with the player playing a talking drum, that African instrument that you adjust with your arm to change the pitch, talking drum and kick drum. So anyway, that was just, it was one of those magical performances that, like, I was already knee deep in percussion in college at that time, but seeing that just, it just somehow changed me to want to continue doing this. Not that I needed help with that, but I don't know. For me, that was a magical performance. And Evelyn Glennie is one of our very few sort of, big name hotshot percussion concerto soloists known the world over. I wish I could remember, there was a panel discussion on percussion concertos at PASIC one year and someone had a name for the queen of percussion or something like that. So anyway, that was my my little closing bit on concertos.
Ben, was that in Dallas?
Yeah, 2008.
Yeah, I went to that same show.
Nice.
Yeah, that was the first percussion concerto I ever saw live. Was my parents got me for my birthday in the spring. They got me tickets to that show to see Evelyn Glennie. And I went there and I remember specifically the talking drum at the beginning of the third movement. That's so funny. We're probably in the same audience back then. That's just crazy.
You see, imagine Caleb.
I remember seeing you.
Yeah, I'm just like,
he's got a balloon, like a red balloon. He's like, do you think she'll do any paradiddles, Dad?
I got those shorts that the guy from AC/DC wears.
Yeah. He's got an AC/DC shirt on. I can see it. Mine was, I want to say it was Martin Grubinger. I don't remember the piece. I wasn't young enough to, I think, really, I was too young to be of that, like, oh, keep track of composers and repertoire. And it was just a neat spectacle. I mean, I was pretty darn young. But I can think of a lot of Evelyn Glennie instances also. I've seen Evelyn Glennie a handful of times when I was younger.
Carly, did you have something?
I have an Evelyn Glennie moment. I also saw her in 2008, but it wasn't in Dallas. It was in Baltimore. She did the UFO Michael Doherty concerto. And it was, I talked about it, the episode. I think I've like fangirled about this with her because it was the night before my senior recital, which was like my first solo recital. And like my dad got me tickets. We went and saw them. And she was just like what I remember is her stage presence and like the theatricality and kind of movement of that piece. I'm sure it was my first percussion concerto, and I've never forgotten that. It was so cool. But also,
question: what did she wear for that performance?
Like a green kind of alien kind of outfit. That's why we were beats, but that's why I remember this.
She performed that at North Texas Performer Eye Time, I guess 2004, and Paul Rennick talked about it, and he said Evelyn shows up wearing this like aluminum foil jumpsuit, and you're like, what the hell is she wearing? And he said the second she walked on stage and started playing, you went, that's exactly what she should have worn.
Yeah, but the other thing why I put me in the chat was I wanted to make a joke that next episode we should have Jennifer Higdon and John Corigliano debate about percussion concertos and the, you know, value and.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I like that.
Anya, can you book them?
I think at this point is John Corigliano, I think, is team percussion concerto, to be clear.
Hey, y'all had Jennifer Higdon once. It didn't go down so well.
Our one.
Yeah, that's the only episode of the podcast ever that we lost.
Lost episode.
Problem. Yep.
Well, she'll probably be thrilled to come back.
She's forgotten us all, I'm sure. Hey, is there any life updates that you want our listeners to know? Anybody? Ksenia, you're at a new program. Caleb, you're at a new program. Where are you now, Ksenia?
Yeah, I am at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts now, and I love it here. So I moved about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, and it's been fantastic. And what else is new? I got married. Yes, thank you. Congratulations.
Casey quit. Ksenia got married.
There we go, Ben. That was your dream. The summer of 69.
That's the song.
Yeah. I'm getting a marimba concerto written for me, which is also part of the reason why I'm so interested in what happens in the concerto world.
Can you share who the composer is? You can say
no. I can say
not no. Yet.
Not yet. It is I'll say it's a composer from Hollywood. So that's nice. But I will reveal more once everything is set and
John
on
Williams.
Paper. John Williams, exactly. Best buddy.
Nice
my
try. Buddy. Yeah. We're too smart. I got married too, so ha.
Ha.
I think I got married first.
Probably. I got married in October. When did you get married?
July?
June. Yeah.
July.
Yeah. Congratulations.
You too, buddy.
Thank you. What else is new, people? Caleb?
Living. I think my next job is going to be University of North Carolina School of the Arts, because I'm currently
following.
I'm actually living in Corpus Christi. I'm back in Texas, my home state, but I'm actually at A&M Corpus Christi, Ksenia's old gig. And funny enough, I am also living in her apartment. I subleased it from her when I was looking for a place, and it actually worked out really nice. I'm glad we were able to make that happen, but it saved both of us a lot of headache, I think. But no, it's been great. I really enjoyed Missouri, but I will say going from seeing endless fields of corn to an endless ocean view is definitely an improvement. So yeah, it's good. It's nice to be back.
Nice. Congrats on the job, buddy, as Casey would say.
Thanks, buddy.
The best, yeah, the buddies. Best person won it. Yeah.
Awesome. Hey, well, thanks for a pretty impromptu reunion episode, and anyone who's listening, enjoy. I don't know. Maybe we'll do this again time to time. I mean, we're still over, you know, but this was fun. So
we're still broken up, but it's fine. It was good.
Yeah, we're definitely still broken up for sure. Yeah, band is not.
Last year, the Beatles released a new song, so we had to one up them.
That's it. Cool. All right, hey, thanks everybody. Well, I think that's episode 342. And see you next time. Bye.